topic is gender and the family in China. So, there's a few themes again. As you've noticed, I like to outline what the themes are for each week's lecture. What are the themes today? What are the dominant ideas or paradigms that govern gender relations at a given time? These change. They're not the same over the period of Chinese history that we're covering in this subject. So there's three primary themes here, or primary paradigms that I'm going to talk about today. One is Confucianism. The second is communism and Mao Zedong's thought. And the third is the market. All three of these given periods in modern Chinese history have been the dominant idea that has shaped gender relations and family relations. In relation to the state as well, the state's played a critical role in gender relations and the family over this time. So the time periods, we're moving from dynastic late Qing Dynasty China through the Republican era and on to the modern PRC and the reform era. The key facets that we'll look at is one is work, marriage, and reproduction. These are the three core ideas that we're going to look at today. Now, there are a few caveats that I need to add before I move forward in today's presentation. The first has to do with cultural ethnocentrism. So often in Western sources we see Chinese womanhood as a victimization story, which often validates Western prejudices about Chinese culture. Now this stems from something that's called Orientalism. Now this idea was pioneered in this very famous book here by Edward Said. And this is Orientalism is about prejudiced outsider interpretations of the East. And these were often formulated during times when European outsiders were in the East as imperial conquerors. It's from the Age of Empire, so you get these ideas of cultural superiority that colour the kind of reports that come out of these countries over time. And in some of the discourses about China and about other parts of Asia, some of these prejudices remain. So we have to be conscious when we analyse subjects like gender, but any time we talk about China, that we have to try and avoid some of the Orientalist stereotypes. I also acknowledge that there are some potential pitfalls for me as a Caucasian Australian male talking about gender issues and women's issues in China. So there are drawbacks there, and I apologise in advance for any potential biases coming up. Another thing we need to deal with is the diversity of the female experience in China. There's lots of dimensions to this. And again, all of these facets of China's diversity that we've gone over in previous weeks come into play. So ethnicity, there's 56 recognised cultural groups, the Minzu. Class, there's all of the socioeconomic disparities that we've discussed in previous weeks. Age, people and women of different age groups have different issues in their lives, that's common sense. Region, we've got the city-rural disparities. There's disparities within cities according to socioeconomic class. So geography plays a big part in the female experience. And also, as I've said earlier, the time period is important. So what's relevant to women in the late Qing Dynasty differs to what's relevant during the nationalist period and the civil war period, which differs again in Mao's China and then in the reform era now. There's changes aplenty there. So we have to keep all of these issues in mind when we're discussing this topic. But in actuality, from what I've seen as an outside observer in, within and without China, is that Chinese women are tough, they're adaptable, and they're socially adept. And there are all of these things and more because China is a cauldron of culture, economic, political, and social change. And it has been so for 100 years. So this breeds tough people, adaptable people that can cope with this change. So please, bear in mind all of these caveats as we proceed, and we'll see what we can make of it. I'm going to begin with the dynastic period prior to 1911. So what are the influences going on during the late Qing dynasty? The first is Confucianism, and I'm going to burrow into Confucianism in more detail shortly. But it is the dominant ideology slash philosophy during this period, and it's quite socially conservative. Economic relations at this time are also key. So, the imperial period is a feudal period. Feudalism embodies certain economic and social obligations, and there are elements of slavery within the feudal economic setup. And also, we have to bear in mind the Mandarin class, the state, or the imperial bureaucracy. Now, being in the Mandarin class, or being closely associated with people in this class, was the key to social mobility and to prosperity in a period, especially in the 19th century, where social problems were beginning to mount. So being a Mandarin or being close to one was the key to having a prosperous existence as the Chinese state began to crumble. So these three things, Confucianism, economic relations, and the Mandarin class, the imperial bureaucracy, these are the key contextual factors to bear in mind when we think about the late Qing era. Alright, yes, we've got some photos. I'm going to show you a pictorial look now at some vision from women in the 19th century. And these photos are quite rare, so this will be a treat. The first one here is a Manchu bride. This photo was taken in 1867. So notice the unique headdress that she's wearing, and also note that because she's Manchu and not Han, there's a different marriage ceremony, a different cultural dress that applies here. This is a Manchu bride with a friend chatting just before the ceremony. Very intimate photos. Bearing in mind mid to late 19th century, this is the very first photography. So this vision is some of the first photographs of China that were ever taken. So this is really interesting footage. Here you see Chinese women grooming each other. We see here women chatting in a courtyard, and these women are probably concubines within one household. Now, if anyone here, or anyone in Bandura, has been to Beijing and had a chance to walk around the hutongs and see that the courtyard home was very much the traditional housing structure that existed at the time. So every household in the hutong had a courtyard in the middle, which was sort of a gathering place within the home where people could talk and chat. Sort of like the lounge room, or the family room in our houses here. But much more communal than that. Here we see mothers and daughters. Now this is an interesting photograph because if you look at their feet are not bound. So these women and children are either low-born Han Chinese, and these low-born people were not, low-born women were not expected to bind their feet for practical reasons as much as aesthetics, or they were from a different ethnic group, so they're possibly they are Manchu. We contrast that with noble-born women, and these women do have their feet bound, and we'll talk about foot binding in a bit more detail shortly. And here's someone that we are familiar with, that we have visited in our story of Chinese history earlier. This is the Empress Dowager Cixi. As a young woman, and she started out life as a royal concubine and amassed quite a deal of power as the favoured concubine of the emperor. Alright, Confucianism, the dominant ideology philosophy of the time. Very important to understand this, even today. So Confucianism is a philosophy for right living, It's a moral philosophy. It's about the cultivation of virtue and the maintenance of ethical principles. And it's a product of a feudal age. It's all about social harmony. Now, bear in mind, Confucius himself lived during the Warring States period, and a couple of thousand years ago. And this was a period of political chaos, social ferment. So, in this time, social harmony was a really important value that was prized. And Confucius's writings and philosophies, or those attributed to him and later Confucian writers, were all about how do you preserve social harmony and social order within an environment that has a tendency towards breakdown and chaos. As we've seen throughout the Chinese long dynastic cycle, we've seen these peaks and valleys of imperial consolidation and then collapse. Imperial consolidation and then collapse. So having order within an environment of chaos is very much part of the Chinese experience. Now, what are the principles of Confucianism? There's a few things that we need to bear in mind. There's something called the five constants, and this is humaneness, justice, etiquette, knowledge, and integrity. Now, I'm not going to go into what each of these mean in detail, so I don't have time, but have a read about Confucianism and you can figure out what these things are. There's also some other virtues, and these are called the four virtues, which are loyalty, filial piety, continency, and righteousness. Now, the one that's of most relevance to us today is filial piety, which is about deference and reverence to one's elders, to one's parents, etc. This is a very important virtue, a virtue in East Asian cultures. So the goal of the four virtues and the five constants is maintenance of social harmony. And it involves, to obtain this social harmony, it involves adherence to social roles. So people have very set roles in a hierarchy that's heavily dominated by age. So this is where the filial piety dimension comes in. Someone's age goes a long way to defining their position, their social role within the society. So age, let's explore this a bit more. There's five Confucian bonds, or five relationships, that are important here, and are age specific. So the first one is ruler and subject. The second is father and son. The third, older brother, younger brother. The fourth, husband and wife. And the final one is senior friend and junior friend. Now, every person within the Confucian society can locate themselves within this matrix of five different relationships. Every interpersonal relationship fits within one or more of these five Confucian bonds. And of course, these five bonds heavily influence gender roles and family relationships and family relations within a Confucian society. So please memorize, if you can, these five Confucian bonds, because they're very important. And when you travel to a society that's influenced by Confucianism, you can see this in action, the way in which people interact with each other and the deference that younger people show to older people is very much evident. And something that is completely lacking in Australia. You don't see the same age difference in Australian society. It's much less formal here. So let's explore this idea of patriarchy then, or male dominance, that seems to be inherent in the five Confucian bonds. So if we look at the right-hand picture, this mother and son picture, this is illustrative of the influence of Confucianism on reproduction and gender roles. Now notice the child is a boy, that's important for this story. So, gender roles. A virtuous woman in a Confucian society is said to have or uphold something called the three subordinations. So what are these? She has to be subordinate to her father before she's married. She has to be subordinate to her husband after marriage, or once she's married. And if her husband dies, then she has to be subordinate to her sons. So if we're talking patriarchy, it doesn't get much more patriarchal than this, does it? A complete life of subordination for the Confucian female. From this, we get a number of social obligations. The woman is the homemaker or wife, so she has to have complete obedience to her husband. The husband has legal control over the wife. Complete legal control. So a woman in this context has very few rights. It's the female's obligation to procreate and to be the bearer of sons. Now, why is this important? Well, sons or male progeny carry on the family line. They carry on the family name. So this is very important. Women were to be confined to the household, so they couldn't be anything else but the homemaker because they weren't allowed to go out very often. As such, they were excluded from education and from many occupations, and definitely from the civil service. So the Mandarin class that I introduced you to earlier, that was all male, completely male. Men, on the other hand, could remarry, and they could have many concubines. And women, what's a concubine? A concubine is like an institutionalized mistress. So, a man has a concubine, he doesn't have to go out and have an affair. He can bring a concubine into his home, who is like his pleasure mistress, but she's part of the family matrix. Now, the gentleman of significant means has a wife and three or four concubines. You can imagine the kind of interpersonal politics between the women within the home in that sort of environment. A lot of interpersonal power play, and very toxic in that environment. Not a pleasant place to be. Now, if a woman's husband dies, then the woman has to uphold the virtue of chastity, and she can't remarry once she's lost her husband. Now, what about marriage customs in this time period? That's just an important point before we move on here. The Hollywood style of marriage and wedding relationship that we're used to here, the love marriage, this is not the historic norm in most societies. So we look at the pictures here. The one on the right is the traditional marriage ceremony from the 1870s. The one on the left illustrates what I was just talking about. This gentleman obviously has some concubines here. Now, marriage customs heavily dependent on the region. And there were three main types of wedding or marriage that were practiced in this feudal era. One was quite shocking, actually. It's called the kidnap marriage. And it's still practiced in some parts of Asia. So, in this instance, a potential groom and some other male members of his family would stake out a potential bride for a while, and eventually they'd get her a wig moment, they'd kidnap her, take her back to the husband's family home, and keep her there isolated for a significant period of time, try and break her down, break her spirit, so that she will submit to the husband and submit to the family and, more importantly, stay there and not try and run off. And this kind of marriage is still practiced in some areas of Central Asia. Another kind of marriage is the paid marriage. So a husband would actually buy a wife from another family. Now, this is a reasonable arrangement if you have a daughter and you want to marry her off and get some kind of reward for that. A paid marriage is possibly a good option for you. Particularly if the groom is someone of noble status, this is something that we're familiar with from the India lectures. And again, particularly in situations where the bride's family is looking for social advancement, having an arranged marriage to someone who's noble-born, someone who might be associated with the Mandarin class, is a good way to ensure one's own family's survival and prosperity. So there's definite economic and social advancement dimensions to the arranged marriage. It's very politicised. And it has nothing or very little to do with the actual relationship between the bride and the groom. Concubines. Institutionalised mistresses, as I've just said. Now, being a concubine is not necessarily a permanent relationship between the man and the concubine. In a sense, wives were for procreation, bearing sons and carrying on the paternal line. Concubines were there for pleasure. So two different gender roles here, separated. Pleasure and love were not something that was generally the actual role of the wife. Because marriages were arranged or paid for or even kidnapped, kidnapped marriages, love and pleasure were not part of that equation. They were purely for, or mostly for child-rearing purposes. As we saw, however, with the Empress Dowager Cixia, a concubine could become in a position where they could accrue substantial power and influence within the family, within the Mandarin class, or even as we saw with Cixia, within the entire country in itself. So being a concubine was not without its advantages to the female, particularly if they're coming from a lower-born family. Now, this book here, Wives and Wives by Jung Chang, this is a classic. Many of you will have read it. And if you haven't, have a look at it. It's written by Jung Chang. She documents the life story of her mother and her grandmother. This dates back to the beginning of the 20th century. Following the lives, or through following the lives of her mother and grandmother, she really documents a lot of the social tumult that went on in China over the last century. But in this book, there is quite an eloquent discussion of marriage customs and concubinage, because her grandmother was sold as a concubine to an army official. So, yeah, have a read of that. It's a very good book. Now, one of the most controversial to our eyes aspects of gender relations in the imperial period is foot binding. Now, this originated during the Tang Dynasty because emperors during this period liked small feet on their dancers. Now, over time, this became an elite practice for all women of noble birth, and it was vital for women if they wanted to be married. It was something that they had to do to ensure their marriageability. So, for example, at weddings, a groom's family would check the bride's feet because normal feet that weren't found were said to bring shame to the groom's family. Men of the period found bound feet sexually appealing, which is ironic because bound feet were usually covered in rotting flesh underneath all the bandages, which men very rarely ever saw. Otherwise they might not have been so turned on by it, probably. But that does tell you how sexual appetites and what's considered beautiful and appealing does change over time according to cultural context. So what's the process of doing this? It's quite horrific. A young girl's feet are continually broken, and then they're bound with a silk cloth to construct a kind of lotus petal, or golden lily, as it was called. So if you can imagine, this is a foot, I know it's my hand, but this is a big toe. It's sort of been folded in half like that to make it smaller. So you can imagine how painful this is for the young girl. And this is sins have to be continually done and continually bound. Because if the feet were unbound, then they start to grow back to normal. So they have to be continually bound and continually kept in pain. And so women with bound feet would be in chronic pain for their entire life. Of course, women with bound feet also couldn't move very fast. So this made it a lot easier to keep them confined to the home. And it meant they couldn't do anything else. So homemaking was the only occupation open to them because of their limited mobility. Now, for lower class women who, this wasn't an issue. They didn't have their feet bound because they needed to be mobile because they engaged in a lot of the labour. So peasant women living on the farm would do a lot of the farm work with the males of the household. So they needed mobility for economic reasons, economic necessity. So on the subject of cultural subjectivity, foot binding is something that very much raises this issue of context. And one of the good things about studying other cultures and studying other time periods is that it prompts you to reflect on your own time, on your own life, and on your own society. So, do us people in the West do strange things in the name of beauty? Well, you could argue that we do. Women wear high heels. Women and men get injected with Botox or have plastic surgery to enhance themselves. Men take steroids to pump themselves up and look better to the opposite sex. So someone in 100 years' time might look back on this and say that's absolutely ridiculous, but these particular practices are very much a product of the time that we live in. So we have to understand foot binding in the same context. And this helps us to avoid that Orientalist trap as well. Now, at the end of the imperial period, and as we move into the Republican era, things start to change. The imperial society that's existed for a few hundred years begins to, well, the empire, the dynasty breaks down for a start. And then China enters the period of chaos that we know as the warlord era. So naturally, as the political situation changes, as the economic situation changes, it also means some of the old cultural practices also begin to fade away, and gender roles begin to change. And one of the pivotal moments for this, in relation to the later story, is the May 4th movement. Now, you may remember the May 4th movement from the China history lecture. In 1919, student-led demonstrations arguing for political reforms, among other things. But in addition to this leaning or this argument for political reform, a number of other things were part and parcel of the May 4th movement that are relevant to today's lecture. So you could interpret the May 4th movement as a protest against some of the conservative excesses of Confucianism. These protests urged a move away from some of the more traditional values of Confucianism, and gender roles, although a minor part, were still a component of these protests, which did include some calls for gender equity. It also helped that women were very much in the vanguard of the protest movement in a way that they hadn't been before. So if you look at the picture on the top right-hand corner, this is an illustration of the May 4th movement, but you can see females very much front and centre there. And they were involved in the organisation of the protests, they were involved in the protests themselves on the ground, they were involved in fundraising, because this movement went on for several months. And they're also involved in public education campaigns to try and bring other people to support the May 4th movement cause. So as I said in previous weeks, the May 4th movement was really the intellectual birth of the Communist Party. And because gender equity, the seed for gender equity was planted in the May 4th movement, It's also planted the seed for gender equity within the Communist Party itself and the latest thought that it would adopt. So a very important moment, a turning point, if you like, in gender relations in the 20th century in China. So let's fast forward now from there to 1949. This is another important watershed moment. The inauguration of the People's Republic, the communists are in power, and the role of women changed dramatically from this point. Mao famously said that women hold up half the sky. Now, why did he say that? Well, for one, it's true, but the communists needed women as a vital component of their state-building project. Gender equity was codified within the People's Republic's initial constitution. So it wasn't just words that Mao was up to. It actually was part of the institutional framework of the PRC right from the beginning. However, we shouldn't interpret what's written in the Chinese constitution as intrinsic rights, as we would interpret similar words in the American constitution, for example. Rights in China, as they continue to be today, are defined by the state. So the state is integral, or became integral, in shaping gender relations and shaping gender roles from 1949 onwards. And one of their first acts was to ban foot binding. So you don't see foot binding anymore in China. There are a few very old ladies that have their feet bound, but they were born well before 1949, so they're very much remnants of the past era. Also, concubinage was banned at this stage too, as a sort of a bourgeois anti-communist excess, something that rich people do, something that class enemies do. So what other key changes do we see? We see emancipation of women through production. So women start to get a stake in the economic production process. We see something called the New Marriage Law in 1950, which is quite a significant change to marriage practices in China. We see females increasingly becoming educated. And with this greater education of women and greater integration into the workforce, we start to see women take on this dual role of homemaker and worker, of procreator and producer for the state. Two very important points. So I'm going to go into each of these four facets in a bit more detail now. So women at work. Women were required for the People's Republic's rapid industrialisation program. They needed the labour. They needed the labour in the factories. They needed the labour on the farms. You can see these propaganda posters here illustrating just that. So evident in these posters. On the left, we are proud to contribute to the industrialisation of the nation. It's broadly what that says there. The one on the right says, strive for an abundant harvest, a mass grain. So both of these illustrate a vastly different gender role from those of the docile, foot-bound housewife or pleasure-giving concubine. Completely different roles. And you can also see that as a very practical reason there for the abolition of foot binding. Because foot-bound women couldn't do this. Couldn't be a part of the productive machine. In 1949, the percentage of females in the workforce in China was 7%. By 2011, that had risen to 67%. So a 60% increase in 60 years, a very significant rise. However, while the workforce participation rate increased quite dramatically, women were still embedded in jobs in which they had little actual decision-making power, so very much lower-level positions, not really climbing up the hierarchy of power in the bureaucracy or elsewhere. the glass ceiling, if you like, very much in effect. Women and marriage. The marriage law in 1950 abolished feudal marriage practices, so kidnap weddings out, paid marriages out, arranged marriages out. These feudal traditions were seen as harmful to women, harmful to children and older people and seniors. And they were abolished. They were also harmful to the productive apparatus of the state. Marriage was redefined as a relationship between two individuals. And there was an attempt made to remove some of the more extreme family obligations of the Confucian hierarchy and remove some of the family influences on that marriage decision. Article 1 of the marriage laws is about free spousal choice, which ends kidnap, paid, arranged marriages. It also discusses monogamy, so no more concubinage. Men were not allowed to take on numerous concubines in addition to their wives. So monogamy is a key to this setup. And also importantly, gender equality was embodied in the marriage laws. So no longer was a wife the property of the husband. No longer did the husband have complete legal authority over the wife. Wives, as well as husbands, were allowed to file for divorce. Now it's interesting, during the Republican period, the Guomindang attempted something broadly similar in 1931 called the Family Code, which they tried to redefine the marriage laws and gender roles in the Chinese Republic. However, this movement failed. One, because of the momentum of tradition, so old habits die hard, as the slide suggests. Plus, a lack of enforcement. So we remember the grassroots of the Guomindang. The Guomindang is a party for the cities, it's a party for the bourgeois. It doesn't have broad-based mass support among the lower classes. So it wasn't in a position to educate people on a mass scale about such a change. So what is quite a fundamental change to gender relationships and marriages. It wasn't in a position to educate, and it wasn't in a position to enforce that change. So the 1931 Family Code failed. But the communists were in a position to educate because they had complete penetration with the party officials of all productive work units in all villages and towns and cities across the country. So these officials were able to educate people in their proximity about what the law was all about, and that to a degree they were able to enforce the law and punish people who didn't comply. So the communist marriage law was much more successful than the earlier incarnation under the KMT. However, again, when you're trying to change thousands of years of tradition, old habits do die hard. It's incredible to push and bring to a halt that kind of cultural momentum. So there was quite a backlash between recalcitrant husbands and families who were protesting against these newly acquired rights of women. So if you compare that perhaps to the conservative white middle class backlash against feminism in the West, different cultural context, but a similar kind of backlash, I think you can appreciate. So what we saw in the Chinese case there was quite high rates of abuse against women who tried to assume some of their new rights and met quite significant resistance from husbands and from families. Despite the fact that the Communist Party did have a penetration of officials throughout the society, there was a lack of solid legal structures to really enforce the new marriage law. So it's one thing to say that women have new rights. It's one thing to have people around who are trying to educate and enforce these rights. But when there is cases of abuse, or when there are cases where these rights are being denied, then with the absence of a legal framework to redress this, was a big problem in trying to institutionalize this completely. Part of the marriage law was to have marriages institutionalized through registration. So to get married, a couple had to register their marriage with the state bureaucracy. Now, a lot of couples went and did this and said they were married before actually having the traditional ceremonies. In some cases, they weren't allowed to have the traditional ceremonies because of family resistance. So, without the traditional rituals, some marriages lacked the kind of legitimacy that you would have if the couple were married in the traditional way. Because of the resistance to the laws, the government relaxed the marriage for a little bit in the late 1950s because it wasn't in a position to ensure complete compliance. So what were the results then? Well, despite this resistance, there was quite a high divorce rate in the early 1950s. So between 1950 and 1952, nearly 1 million people, or 1 million couples, I should say, filed for divorce. Unfortunately, however, there was also quite a high suicide rate at this time from women who were trapped in marriages they couldn't get out of. So although this right was there for them to claim, they weren't in a position to do so, so suicide was the only way out. Incidentally, if you look at the pictures, the two black and white ones illustrate village-level education campaigns about the marriage law. So you've got Communist Party officials telling people about the law and how they can claim their rights. So this is the scale of education campaigns were conducted at. Very much like the lecture here. Now, women in education, this is the third big change in Mao's China. Educating women was necessary if women were to be active participants in an industrial workforce. This is the same story in the West during the Industrial Revolution, same story here. If you want industrial workers, they need a certain level of education to be involved. So female education levels. Before 1949, less than 20% of young girls attended school, so what we would call primary school. By 1976, that was up to 96%. By 2010, 55% of females over 25 years old had completed secondary education. So it's quite a significant increase on pre-1949 education levels. An example here, if we look on the right-hand side of the slide, is a woman called Wu Yifang, who was the first female university president in China. Now, as industrial workers and procreators, Chinese women during this period had to take on a very difficult dual role. And there's several dimensions to this. So women were the new proletarians. They were revolutionaries, just like the men, holding up the banner of the Red Republic. But they were also the homemaker. They still had to procreate, they still had to carry on the family line as the childbearer. Now, childbearing in this context was about upholding the future of the revolution. And indeed, during the Mao Zedong period, women were encouraged to have as many babies as possible in order to enhance the revolution by building the population. So what we see here is new rights plus old responsibilities, which put females under tremendous pressure. And you can see where I come to say that Chinese women are tough. Holding up the revolution, holding down the job, and supporting the family, three very difficult roles. Now, similarly, in our society, women also have to face this dual role of being a family maker and being a worker at the same time. Very difficult. So let's look now at the Cultural Revolution in particular, and how this is a good case study about how women's roles changed significantly in the communist period. So the Cultural Revolution saw a few weeks ago was about making a revolutionary society. It was Mao Zedong's plan to mobilise young people as the vanguard to try and reinstate him to his power, to the pinnacle of the Communist Party power hierarchy. It was about cultivating new political subjects, about cultivating people's political minds. And in so doing, this liberated women, made them socialist revolutionaries. Women were at the forefront of Mao's Red Guards, the revolutionaries. So if you look at the pictures over here, women were very much present in this youth movement. In a way, they hadn't been in previous protest movements. They started to become so in the May 4th movement, but now in Mao's China, this equality was very much evident. There was some female representation in positions of low-level political authority during the Cultural Revolution. Because remember, a number of officials were removed from positions of power through the Cultural Revolution by the Red Guards. Someone had to step in, and there were many women in influential positions where they could assume these positions of power. This was a time of ideology over tradition. So remember the abolition of the four olds. Some of the four olds included traditional family structures, traditional Confucian hierarchies. These were eroded away by the totalitarian leanings of the Cultural Revolution and the Red Guards. So gender roles changed necessarily because some of these old cultural practices were inherently patriarchal. Also, the collectivization of agriculture was important, because this eroded some of the family-based patriarchal systems that existed in agriculture and in farmland. And it really, instead of having a family farm, we had these vast collective farms where everyone is a single atomized unit within the collective rather than members of a family unit in relation to the rest of society. So this is important. Collectivization really hammers away at the social bonds of the family. We also see in the imagery of the Cultural Revolution the desexualization of women. So if you look in the picture, if you look at how the Red Guards are dressed, everyone's wearing the same kind of clothing, the same attire. It's very asexual. There's nothing gendered about the clothes that they're wearing. And this was to symbolise the fact that everyone was a revolutionary comrade, regardless of their gender. We see a trend in some of the propaganda from this period to lionise some of the female heroes of the past. One of these heroes is Liu Hulan, who was a young female, was a young woman who lived during the Chinese Civil War. She was born in Shanxi Province, and she joined the Communist Party in 1946. And she became the secretary of the All China Communist Women's Federation. Now, why did she become a hero? Well, she was executed by the Kuomintang Army in 1947. The Kuomintang Army rolled into her village. She refused to denounce any of her fellow Communist Party comrades within the village, despite the fact that several villagers were executed in front of her eyes. And in response to this, she went up and placed her head next to the executioner's axe rather than denounce her Communist Party comrade. So she became a significant figure in the Cultural Revolution folklore. Another important female during the Cultural Revolution is Jiang Qing, who was also known as Madame Mao. She was Mao's third wife. She had been an actress during the 1930s under the name Lan Ping. But she married Mao in Yan'an in 1938. She became a member, an influential member of the Gang of Four during the Cultural Revolution. So if you remember, the Gang of Four was a clique near the pinnacle of the Communist Party who were assisting Mao to kick off the Cultural Revolution and get him into power. Now, Chen was influential in the propaganda apparatus of the Cultural Revolution. And Xi was held up as a champion of proletarian culture and Mao Zedong thought. You can see that in the posters here, in the picture. Again, look at the non-gendered clothing that she's wearing. Of course, however, after Mao dies, Jane, a member of the Gang of Four, loses power in the power struggle that exists, and then she's held in prison under house arrest until her death in 1991. Now, we're not getting any volume on this video. But this is on loop, so have a watch anyway. This is another example of Communist Party female heroism. This is an opera, a classic revolutionary opera called The White-Haired Girl. So I'll outline the story for you. It's set during the 1930s. The opera itself is based on the lives of six different peasant women from Hubei province. And the idea is that it illustrates the suffering of the peasantry during this time. The main character is a lady called Xiar. Her father was executed and she was sold as a concubine to the local landlord. However, while under captivity, she escapes and flees to the mountains and lives in a cave for a while, which is where her hair turns white. Now, the propaganda angle to this story is that Xiar gets revenge against the landlord. She returns, denounces the landlord in front of her friends, then her fiancé, Wang Dao-chun, returns from fighting the Japanese as part of the Communist Party army, and Wang removes the local landlords and redistributes land to the peasantry. So here we can see the emancipation of Xiar is very much related to the emancipation of the Chinese peasantry and the Chinese people. And makes for quite a ripping story as well. So what we see through this period is a link between intimate relationships and the building of state power. Having marriages equates to social harmony, which equates to greater labour productivity, which equates to a stronger Chinese nation. So it identifies marriage with the selfless project of socialist liberation and construction. Also, marriage is seen as, or becomes a tool of government power. So the act of marriage registration that I talked about before, this allowed the state to monitor a couple's reproduction. It allowed them to monitor their people's intimate relations and how their families progressed. So the marriage law was not all emancipatory. It was also a tool of state power and very much linked to the Communist Party's project to use marriage as a facet of its nation-building project. Alright, let's move now to gender and family in the post-Mao Zedong era. So after 1976, we move into the economic reform period, and it's a very interesting time in China. In this period, we see economic reforms and we see the social consequences of those reforms, which I talked about last week, which ironically makes the realisation of the 1950 marriage law possible on a mass scale. We see social, institutional and legal developments which change the gender roles of women and allow the marriage law to really be fulfilled in practice as well as in word. These changes in the society made free marriage choice desirable and also practical. So the theme here is that people were freed from traditional parental controls, embodying the spirit of the marriage law. However, we also see this continuance of the urban-rural dichotomy, these regional differences between city and country, which keep coming up in our story of China, are equally relevant in history, and I'll show you how. Now, remember from last week, this is the map of the special economic zones. These were established in the 1980s. They were a driver of China's export-led economic miracle, and they acted as a magnetic attractor of labour from the country to the cities where these zones existed. So this is key to understanding the changing gender roles and gender relationships across China after 1976. So let's look at rural women first. So the traditional work pattern was that women worked on the farm beside other family members. Now, as a consequence of the reform era migrations from country to city, we see some rural women take on more responsibility as their male counterparts left rural areas for the cities. So there's more work for women to do in regional areas. We also see many young girls or young females migrate to the cities looking for work, particularly in the special economic zones. And they were able to send remittances home to their families, so they're earning an income and sending a portion of that back to their families, incomes that they wouldn't able to be to otherwise earn in the backward rural areas. So all of this presented new economic opportunities for women in China. There's opportunities for entrepreneurialism, to be able to start one's own business, particularly in service industries where the start-up costs are not very high. This really suited females who didn't come from a big capital base. However, many of the same problems continue. When the economic opportunities are available elsewhere, you get a drain, a feedback loop, sorry. All the most talented people leave country areas to the cities, and it keeps the country areas with a lower intellectual base, a lower capital base, and less people. So a conservative feedback loop, if you like. Now what about for urban women? What's going on here? We see new economic and educational opportunities arise. This is part of the Communist Party's social bargain of expanding and raising people's standards of living. There's manufacturing jobs to be had in the special economic zones, particularly for women in manufacturing sectors like electronics, toy assembly, sewing and textiles, etc., where women were thought to have nimble fingers and were better suited to this kind of assembly work than men. Now, because of this, in the Shenzhen zone in particular, up to 70% of the workforce in this zone was female. Now, flip side of this is that there was less rights and legal representation for women working in the special economic zones. These are people who are earning low wages. For young girls who migrated from the country to the SEZs, they didn't have much support, they didn't have much legal representation, they were in a very much vulnerable position vis-a-vis their employers. So they suffered low pay, long working hours, minimal workers' rights. Some of them didn't even sign contracts, they just were brought on, and many of them were not paid properly, so many workers in the SEZs were not paid for long periods of time. So you can imagine the flow-on effect of that. If you have come to the city in order to earn a wage and send some back to your family, if you're not getting paid, then it has flow-on effects, not just for you, but for your families back home. Conversely, though, outside of the SEZs, we see the growth in a middle class, a consuming middle class in China, an urban middle class. So for females in this environment, from this class level, there's greater opportunities for education, particularly higher education, which were not there before. We see people have a higher disposable income. So we see a fashion revolution, if you like, a revolution in consumerism that was just not available during the Mao era. And part of this disposable income revolution is The growth is something we take for granted. It's leisure time. Now, in terms of relationships, the growth in leisure time has some real practical consequences. So, number one, an increase in leisure time means there's an increasing opportunity for young males and young females to interact. There's an increasing opportunity to find a partner that didn't exist before. There was a growth in workplaces in which there were males and females working together. There was a growth in the availability of leisure activities, or things that are in the services sector, so restaurants, shopping malls, karaoke parlors, including this one here. Curse knows if you picked what that was. Yeah, this is a karaoke parlour in Yanji, in Yanbian, that I went to in December. A karaoke parlour is a really interesting place. It's like a hotel room, if you like. It's serviced by waitresses, you get beer, nibbles, whatever you like. Massive big screen TV with numerous microphones and you can go crazy singing your favourite tracks and getting increasingly intoxicated in the process. Good fun. So yes, there's all of these new entertainment options that are springing up increase the availability of potential marriage partners and the possibility that you can run into them. And also as a consequence of this, we see there's an increase in premarital sexual activity as well. So if you take all of this, this is really blowing apart some of the traditional relationship practices that had existed definitely in the dynastic period, but some of those have lingered on into the PRC era, but the reform, economic reform period, has blown a lot of them away. Marrying out is another option that's a possibility for some Chinese women to improve their lives. Could be with foreign nationals, could be with overseas Chinese, or people living in Taiwan. So the question is this for life? Is this a strategic calculation? Well, there's lots of ways to look at this. One, it helps a Chinese woman escape poverty, although however poor women are not necessarily in demand with foreign suitors. Conversely, it could be for romance, definitely for love. Lots of love marriages have sprung up in this way. Could be that Chinese women are looking for more equality in their partnership. So some of the aspects of male patriarchy still exist due to the Confucian social hierarchy, and that does have an influence on relationships even until to this day. Again, I keep coming back to this rural to urban migration. This is really an enormous event. I can't understate how much this is an important... this migration is an important event in the modern Chinese story. So what are some of the reasons why women decided to participate in this great people movement? Well, one could be to find a partner, because there's always a greater choice of eligible bachelors in the cities. Definitely to find employment, because there were new employment opportunities springing up in the special economic zones and across the services sector within urban environments. Definitely more education opportunities available to females in the cities as opposed to in regional centres. And if you look at education opportunities for anyone, full stop, men or women, and you can see this in Australia too, especially for higher education opportunities in the cities, there's much more going on than there are in regional centres. Although you guys here in Orewadonga are lucky in that regard. There's also the self-development factor. So once economic freedom is allowed, freedom of movement, some young people just think, I've got to get out of here, I've got to establish myself in the world, try something new, broaden my horizons. So that's definitely a factor there. Cultivating independence. So, in regional areas, often more conservative, some young people just need to establish their own identity and react and rebel against some of the conservative social mores of their parents. Now, it's often that these actually actualized for young people. Sometimes it all goes horribly wrong. Sometimes rural women get drawn into the sex industry, and there's often a perception that waitresses or karaoke parlor girls or hotel clerks, that they are sex workers on the side. Now, whether that is just a perception or it's actually true is a matter of debate. However, there is some evidence in the academic literature that females that do act as sex workers are in a, put themselves in a position where they can maximise their earnings and improve their social position in a way that wouldn't be possible in other professions. So there's a mixed view on this literature. But it does have its dark side. So in the urban areas, there is a substantial, or has been a substantial increase in prostitution and female trafficking. So again, for a vulnerable female coming in from the country who's not streetwise, in unfamiliar surrounds, who really needs to earn a living, they're open to exploitation. Some of them get pressed into sex slavery. Now bear in mind, this is not a uniquely Chinese phenomenon. This happens all around the world as well. And that vulnerability factor is really key here. An example that I'm aware of, although not strictly Chinese, but it does happen in China, are female defectors that cross the border from North Korea. Now these are people that are extremely vulnerable because they know that if they get caught and sent back, that they'll be put straight into detention camps. So often young girls in this situation get sold off to Chinese men as brides, and they have little means of resistance or escape because of the fact that they can get sent straight back to North Korea and into the arms of the coercive apparatus there. So this does happen. Now I'm going to finish off today by looking at sort of the ultimate gender and family role question in China during the last 20 years, and that's the one-child policy. It's the most infamous example of the state's penetration into relationship and marital affairs. Now, it was instituted in 1979. It did come on the back of discussions about population control within the Communist Party during the early 1950s. So in 1953, abortion was legalised in the PRC. 1954, there were birth control study groups within the ideological training sessions that people were having at their local level. And in 1956, there was some propaganda push to limit people's childbirth that had no real visible effect because it wasn't backed up by any incentives. And of course, now encouraged people to have more children, which completely ended any push for limitations that had been adopted previously. Mao saw having a larger population as a comparative advantage in relation to China's competitors in the Cold War. So while the United States might have more riches and better weapons, the Chinese had more people, and that was very much a deterrent against their Cold War enemy. So during the Mao era, we see China's population actually doubles. So this is quite incredible levels of population growth during this period. Some people see those drives during the early 50s to try and limit population as a missed opportunity. Had the Communist Party seized on this and attempted to limit population at this time, it would have prevented a whole generation of people reaching childbearing age by the time the one-child policy was instituted in 1979, and would have put a limit on some of the population pressure that had developed in the intervening period. So what's the aim of the one-child policy? Well, it's fairly obvious, but we'll go through it anyway. It aims to reduce population growth to zero by 2050 through a series of rewards and punishments. So that's population growth. Now, obvious reasons. The rapidly increasing population puts the Communist Party's social contract of the done era, that give us support in exchange for us raising your standards of living, puts that in jeopardy, puts a strain on government resources, puts a strain on government services. It creates environmental problems, creates resource constraints, infrastructure costs, land use and management problems, waste disposal problems. So you can see there's quite a compelling reason to limit population growth in China. Now, what are some of the rewards offered for compliance with the one-child policy? Well, couples will offer free medical care, free basic education, exceptions from military service in some instances, priority housing and cash subsidies. So this raft of incentives, with a quid pro quo, if you like. You limit to one child, we'll give you all these goodies. Punishments for non-compliance included fines, loss of jobs, could include expulsion from the party for Communist Party members. In extreme cases, it could include forced sterilisation. Now, if you remember the blind lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, who I introduced to you last week, part of his MO as a lawyer was to fight for women who had been forcibly sterilised or who had suffered other abuses as a result of one-child policy. This is a demographic breakdown of China by age, group and gender. So you can see for each age group, that's the percentage of the population that exists in that age group. What's this arrow? The yellow arrow. This is the initial influence of the one-child policy. You can see in this particular age demographic, 30 to 34. The red arrow shows the beginnings of a further decline in birth rate. And it's 15 to 19 years old. So late 1980s is when this age group is beginning to be born, early 1990s. So if possible, this is when we're starting to see the reform era really start to raise people's standards of living, so increased affluence, new economic opportunities for women, higher levels of female education starting to kick in, providing an incentive for declining birth rates. But these kind of demographic charts are really interesting to look at, to see how population segments are distributed amongst age demographics. This chart or graph charts population growth rates up to 1988. Now you can see the one measurement pointing down, that's the Great Leap Forward. So you can see there's quite a significant impact of that famine event in just that 1 year measurement, completely apart from the trend of the other 40 years on this map. We can see a decline in birth rates from about the end of the Cultural Revolution and a steep drop from 1981 once the one-child policy comes into being. We see some growth increases in the birth rate in around 1985. Could be some resistance to the policy kicking in. Or higher standards of living. So in contrast to what I said on the previous slide, higher standards of living may make it more practical for people to have more than one child. So either way, you really need to look at the statistical evidence to come to a view one way or another. But the key points here, growth rates are much lower from 1973 onwards. However, there's no contraction. The fact that these lines on the graph are pointing upwards means that they're still positive growth rates. So Chinese population is still growing, albeit at slower rates. This is a global comparison of Chinese birth rates. So the birth rate in China at the moment is comparable to what you see in Canada, Russia or Scandinavian countries, and is slightly higher to that we see here in Australia. This is in 2009. This is a forecast of youth population decline over time, stretching to 2050. So what we see here is that a population contraction will inevitably occur in the population age bracket aged 15 to 24 years old. So, is is this going to bring about a demographic imbalance? This is a key consideration here. So let's look at the results of the policy now. Since 1980, it's been estimated that up to 300,000 births have been prevented as a result of the policy. It's been most successful in the cities, but has encountered much more resistance in the countryside. And also there's a number of economic incentives to have more than one child, particularly if you live in the countryside for economic reasons. So what happens then when everything does go to plan? What are some of the unintended consequences of the policy? And that's what I'd like to explore now. I did have a couple of videos for you, but we're running a bit late, so we'll skip them. One of the consequences that's increasingly important is China's becoming a bachelor nation, if you want. There's an imbalance between the number of males and the number of females as a result of the preference for males that exists in some elements of Chinese culture. Traditionally, boys are valued over girls because boys perpetuate the family name, and sons support their parents in old age, whereas daughters are married off into other families and go on to support their husband's family. There's a growing gender imbalance. So the current ratio is 117 men to 100 women. We can see that imbalance on the slide here in the graph. And this is the difference between male and female population, 0 to 19 years old age bracket. And it's a girl's market, so if you're a female in urban China, I mean, you do have to pick a litter, if you like, as far as male suitors go. Less than you begin hope, though, we see some tendency towards selective abortions of females and some instances of infanticide where young girls are killed after birth. It's estimated by 2020 that there will be 40 million unmarried men in China. So is that likely to be a social tinderbox of tension? Do we see young men without partners, angry, socially isolated? So this could be an explosive problem in combination with other problems as well, such as poverty and other social issues. Second consequence is an overburden on the healthcare system. So 20% of the population over the age of 65 by 2040, over 50 million over the age of 80 by that time. So elderly people need a lot more healthcare and a lot more from the health system than people of younger age brackets. And this has to be paid for, so this is an increasing cost burden to the state. It's an increasing cost burden shifted onto people of the working age who are paying for it, and there's fewer working age people to produce productive costs, or to produce the economic production that will pay for this healthcare. So let's compare that with the US demographic imbalance. China and the United States. So the demographic issue has been identified in the United States as a big future cost burden problem. But if we look at the comparison with China, we can see the Chinese case is just so much bigger by the number. Now the final consequence is a little bit more subjective. It's to do with the growth of Generation Me, or some of the consequences of being raised in a single child household. Now, some of these issues are subjective, and these shouldn't be taken as generalisations. But the Generation Me idea is that one child, sole focus of parents' attention, makes them possibly more narcissistic, theorise that they have difficulty learning to share, or learning about limits, or learning conflict resolution. For people like me who've already got one child and are getting hassled out by relatives that when you're going to have another one, they always trot out these arguments as well, most annoyingly. But let's have a look. The spoiled rotten kid So what commitments does a consumerist loving child like this have to the Communist Party state building project?
One has to wonder.
A different angle. This is a picture from the Beijing Intelligence Capability Kindergarten. Now, many of you may have heard of the stage mother phenomenon, where parents invest their whole life's worth into the performance and achievement of a single child. So this, when you've only got one, it's possible that
you can heavily invest your interest in that child.
Sometimes they're worth it, like this child named Xu Chui Shui, who's a piano prodigy and a kickboxer. This is a famous lady called Chun Shu. She was a high school dropout and social rebel, but she's turned into a best-selling author. So this raises the legitimacy question. Self-destruction versus anti-state. Chun has made a living out of writing novels about this kind of question in Chinese society. But it's a live one. And this last one is another issue that arises. This is from the Tianjin Weight Reduction Hospital. Gluttony plus Western diets, which is something new in the Chinese experience, which was not seen. So this is a symptom of the one-child policy and the impact of China's economic opening. This has a cost to the state through healthcare as well. So the key question posed by all of these pictures is, are any of these consequential to the power of the Communist Party state, to the Chinese state? Are any of these things a threat to the legitimacy and the power of the state? So this gives you a clue to the kind of political red lines that the Communist Party draws to political discourse in the state. But are these problems to do with the individual? Are these problems to do with sort of social gender issues? Or are these things that have a direct influence on the Communist Party's power? These are some of the discussion points that I'd like to leave you with today. So in sum, as we wind up, over the last century, the female experience in China has been extremely diverse for a whole number of reasons that I've outlined. Gender roles have changed significantly over this period as economic, political and social circumstances have changed. Gender equity has increased, particularly after 1949, but there are still substantial gender inequalities. These things have been driven by political and economic transformations. However, old traditions are still rather influential. And finally, gender issues in each of the periods that we've looked at today are tied to state power. So that final point is really important. Gender issues are tied to state power. Now, next week, just a brief introduction. We're looking at youth and popular culture. So the historic context here. Young people have been at the forefront of every significant movement in China for more than a century. So in my lecture, we're going to go from Red Guards to sex, drugs and rock and roll. Youth rebellion versus state power. Yeah, I've got people giving me the horns here in the crowd. Where do young people sit within the Communist Party's social bargain? That's where we're going to finish off with our final China lecture next week. Thanks for your time. Thank you, Bandura. See you next week.